This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
If no, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
What's it like when someone you really care about falls into a world of mis and disinformation? When their life has become dominated by conspiracy theories, strange ideas, stuff that might be actually putting their health at risk. Is it better to call it out or try to ignore it? And how can you tell if your loved one has fallen down a wormhole? G'day, it's Dave Marchese with you for Hack. Coming up, you're going to hear from Hannah, who always thought that her cousin Lauren had some wacky ideas about health treatments that ended up costing her her life.
I got to know Lauren so much better after her death than I ever did while she was alive.
Yeah, our long listen of the week is coming up very soon. It's a really, really intriguing look at Lauren's story and what drove her to try everything from bleach to animal drenches to try to heal herself. If you've been through something like this with a close friend or family member, I'm keen to hear, how did you deal with it? How hard was it? How this stuff might be impacting your relationship with that person. First, though, we're going to get into a very interesting political story.
Hack.
I think this is about communicating that Australians are frustrated, that we deserve better. And I think more people need to be standing up, putting their head above the parapet and challenging people like the Prime Minister.
On Triple J.
Yeah, you might have been seeing this across your feeds in the headlines. A Gen Z media founder, popular creator, who is saying maybe I might be able to force the Prime Minister out of Parliament. Hannah Ferguson, co-founder of Cheek Media, announcing she's ready to take on Anthony Albanese in his own seat. So could someone in their 20s with a big following actually end up defeating the Prime Minister in a seat he has held for decades? If you were given the option, would you vote for Hannah over Albo? I'm keen to hear your thoughts on this. Message in 0439757555. And what does all this mean for Labor? We're going to get into some of that with a political analyst very soon. But first, here's Alice Angeloni with a bit of a recap.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese has a new political opponent.
The PM seat, no less.
It's my seat, it's my home. The inner west of Sydney is where I call home.
For a while now, content creators have had a lot to say about politics, and they're already having a big impact on elections. But how would you feel about seeing one on the ballot?
Hannah Ferguson wants to add the title of politician.
The 28-year-old announcing she's running as an independent candidate in Prime Minister Anthony Albanese's inner west seat of Grayndler. Albo has held the seat since 1996.
It takes a lot to put your hand up to run for Parliament, to open every part of your life to public scrutiny, and it takes a lot to run against Albanese, who was known for being a ruthless political operator.
Last year, Hannah announced she planned to run as an independent in the Senate, but she's now shifted focus to challenge Albo's seat in the House of Reps. So why?
I think that he, as our local elected representative, isn't doing the job that I think our electorate deserves, and we want better community representation.
Hannah is the co-founder and CEO of left-leaning media company Cheek Media. They've got 254,000 followers on Instagram and have been part of a recent wave of new media reaching younger audiences online.
You may remember that one of the biggest scandals in politics last year was influencers, new media creators, being invited to attend the federal budget lockup.
They ruffled feathers last year when they were invited to the budget lockup and got the invite again this year. Hannah says she intends to step away from Cheek Media next year to start campaigning full-time. Since dropping the news on Instagram 2 days ago, she's been doing the media rounds, laying out some of the key issues she'll be campaigning on, including gas taxation and gambling reform.
Our Prime Minister is failing on two big issues, and that is the gas tax export that is supported by an overwhelming majority of Australians, and this kind of failure to actually stand up and challenge gambling advertising.
She's also talked about taking action on Gaza.
Everyone wants to change things, but knocking off a Prime Minister is a different case, isn't it?
I think we only need to look at the surge of One Nation in recent months to say that there's no safe seat in this country. We need every elected official in this country to be treating their local community like it's a privilege to serve them.
Hack. Triple J.
Ali Angeloni reporting there, and some comments coming through on our text line. Someone says 100%, Hannah. But then another person saying, oh my God, no, F off influencers. Is that person's opinion there? Someone else saying, I know there's been a bit of a shift in how people view the parties, but this is just one person's goal. Look, let's get into this a little more now with a person who has been watching this very closely. His name is Professor Mark Kenny, and he's one of Australia's most influential political analysts, and that's because he was a journalist for many years. He now works with ANU. Mark, thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Should the Prime Minister be worried here? Could Hannah Ferguson have a real chance?
Well, I suppose there's really two questions. One is whether she has a real chance. We won't know that until the election, and we won't have a good judgment really to make on it until we're getting closer to the election and we can factor in a few things. But the other question is, does it matter to him? And the answer to that is yes, it does, because it's likely that she's going to take either a lot of votes off him or a significant enough chunk off him to make him campaign more strongly in his electorate. Of course, prime ministers, you know, have a huge national profile that usually holds them in pretty good stead in their own electorates. But if they're facing a challenge locally, as John Howard showed us in 2007, you need to take it very seriously.
And maybe, as was the case with John Howard, the person who is mounting this fight is someone with their own profile, someone who is well known in the community, particularly among young people, especially in that inner west area of Sydney. I mean, we haven't seen Anthony Albanese say too much about this yet. Why do you think that is?
Well, I suppose he's got a lot on his plate as Prime Minister. There's a fair bit happening. But also, I suppose he's probably not wanting to even talk about the election, which is still the best part of 2 years away, and probably not wanting to give any more profile to any of the candidates that might be running against him. But at the same time, he'll be looking at this candidate and saying to himself, I imagine this is a different class of candidate and one that he will need to be taking seriously.
Can you tell us a bit more about Anthony Albanese's seat of Grangelaw? What kind of electorate is it?
It's a very progressive seat. That's the first thing to say about it. If you go back to the last election, for example, Anthony Albanese won it without it having to go to preferences. He ended up with 66.8% of the vote after preferences were distributed. Importantly, it wasn't the Liberals who came second. It was the Greens. They ended up with 33% after the distribution of preferences. So it's a safe Labor seat. Where its voters don't vote Labor, they tend to vote Greens or for other progressive candidates. It's something that's going to be interesting as we get closer to the election. And I think that's actually an important point to make here. We're so far out from an election. If there have been significant circumstantial changes, then a strong candidate who's presenting on the left of the Prime Minister might be someone who eats a fair way into his support base.
Have things changed a lot over the past few decades, Mark? Like, I imagine a couple of decades ago, it might have seemed a bit laughable, someone in their 20s coming and saying, I'm going to challenge here in a seat that the Prime Minister's held for many years. But with the growth of independence and the political environment in Australia changing so much over the past little while, are we starting to see a bit of a shift here?
I think we are. I think there's a sense that voters, particularly younger voters coming onto the roll, are not rusted onto one party in the way that 10, 20, 30 years ago and beyond that was the norm. And with that comes the possibility of volatility, the possibility of an upset. I think we're seeing quite a creative redrawing or re-expression of democratic habits across the electorate. And I think that means that no seat really is safe in the way it used to be talked about.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with Professor Mark Kenny from ANU about this news that political commentator, Cheek Media co-founder Hannah Ferguson has announced that she's going to run against Anthony Albanese in his Sydney seat at the next federal election. Messages flying through on the text line now. Someone saying, I would vote for her. It's time for a change. Another person, though, saying, what is Hannah's political experience? Someone else, would I vote for Hannah Ferguson? Yes. How great would a progressive, open-minded, forward-thinking woman who cares about our future be? Tax gas, that person says. And another person saying, is she doing it because she has something better to offer or because she doesn't like him? Mark, it sounds like what you're saying is at this time when political environment's changing, young people are increasingly making up more of the voting population, it is important that the political establishment doesn't underestimate someone who is popular among young people.
Yeah, that is exactly what I'm saying. Hannah Ferguson seems to be the kind of person who might otherwise have been in the Labor Party a bit like the, you know, the Teals are the kind of people who might otherwise have been in the Liberal Party if the Liberal Party hadn't become such a kind of conservative machinist type party. She's presenting now as someone who brings a lot of credibility, a lot of profile, and she's the sort of person which Labor would have liked to have had in its ranks and probably still would, quite frankly, except that she's not. She's decided the Labor Party is too much of a kind of a middle road machine, and she's wanting to see principled stances taken. And I think that's going to be quite trying for a Prime Minister to try and defend his record to his electorate at the same time as signalling, as a Prime Minister must, to the broader national community.
So with all of that in mind, Mark, what are going to be the biggest challenges for Hannah Ferguson, you know, keeping this momentum up and getting across the line?
It's always really difficult for independents to run against major parties. She will have challenges raising money. It's important how many people in Grindler see her and hear her, because that's the way our electoral system works. She was, as I understand it, Hannah Ferguson was talking about running for the Senate. Her profile would make her, I think, a very compelling Senate candidate. She's probably thinking that running against the Prime Minister brings its own publicity as well. As I say, it all comes down to this sort of new environment where wild and woolly things are possible in elections that just weren't really credible only, say, two or three decades ago.
Very interesting indeed. A lot of people, especially in this audience, I'm sure, will be keeping it across it. Professor Mark Kenny from ANU, really appreciate you coming on.
Thanks a lot, Dave.
And so many different opinions coming through. Someone saying, I would love to vote for Hannah as a Grindler resident, but I would have preferred to vote for her in the Senate so that Labor doesn't lose their leader. Another person saying, why would a progressive person try to unseat the most progressive PM in decades? That's that person's opinion on the text line. And another person says, it really doesn't matter if she's an influencer or not. Politicians have to start somewhere and at some age. It all comes down to the Australian public being able to recognise what is good, bad, and just fluff. And yeah, look, we're going to try and speak with Hannah Ferguson in the weeks ahead, so you'll be able to put some of these questions to her. Obviously, always happy to speak with the sitting member for Grainler, the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, so hopefully we'll hear from him on Hack soon.
Hack. She was cycling through specialists and treatments for years, desperately trying to understand what was happening inside her body.
On Triple J.
What do you do if someone you love gets caught up in a web of mis or disinformation that's not only removed from reality, but is potentially putting their health at risk? When do you call it out? Like, when does your concern risk isolating them? But then also, when does your support become complicity? Well, we're about to hear from someone who's grappled with all of those questions. Hannah McElhinney has been on a journey into the dark heart of alternative medicine after something really tragic happened to her cousin Lauren. Now, Lauren believed she had a debilitating condition and was going to extreme lengths to try to heal herself. Hannah's spent years investigating Lauren's death and emerged from this spiral with a lot to say about alternative medicine, conspiracy theories. She's actually written a book about it. It's called Wormhole and it's out now. And Hannah's with us now to talk about it. Hannah McElhinney, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's explore the story of your cousin, Lauren. Can you tell us a bit more about her and what she was like?
Yeah, so Lauren was my older cousin. She was 5 years older than me, and she embodied the quintessential older 90s cool girl, boy band posters, nail art. The other side of that was I also remember her being quite sleepy, which is an interesting thing to remember. But a lot of my memories of seeing Lauren around school holidays or Christmas involved needing to wait for her to wake up.
So did Lauren always think that she was unwell? That was something you remember from childhood?
There was very little awareness around certain chronic illnesses in the early 2000s. And so it wasn't until Lauren was in her later teenage years, about 16 years old or 15, would go to see physios and massage therapists. And that really started her journey into getting kind of her first two diagnoses over those years, which was chronic fatigue syndrome or ME/CFS and fibromyalgia.
So Hannah, when was it that Lauren started to believe that she had Lyme disease, which is this condition that's caused by ticks, and more specifically, so-called chronic Lyme disease.
That was much later. So that would have been in the years pre-COVID. She looked into hard-to-define, mysterious chronic conditions that are invisible in their symptoms, or their symptoms might be inconsistent or change. She was looking into those types of diagnoses. But when she discovered chronic Lyme, which I should say here is a contested diagnosis in the United States, for example, medical authorities there will still contest the diagnosis of chronic Lyme. They sort of talk about post-treatment Lyme disease syndrome, which is where the active infection has left a person's system, but maybe they've got ongoing symptoms. But here in Australia, our medical authorities don't recognize Lyme disease as endemic. They have not been able to identify ticks here that carry the Lyme disease bacteria. And so because of that, there is a group of people who are experiencing these symptoms, neurological symptoms, pain, fatigue, those symptoms that are consistent with Lyme disease symptoms, that are advocating strongly for more inquiry into this area. And they do argue that chronic Lyme disease does in fact exist.
It's a really controversial topic, and I mean, over the years in Australia, there have been inquiries into this, looking into it. I think health experts here say that there are no proven cases of Lyme disease being caught in Australia. Is that right?
That's right, yes.
So what sort of treatments was Lauren using to try and treat this chronic Lyme disease, which she believed that she had?
So all sorts. To the extent that when my family recovered her possessions after she'd died, they found bags and bags and bags of all sorts of pills and substances, veterinary ivermectin. So this is something that rose in popularity during the COVID years. Ivermectin is an antiparasitic medication that is used in humans in certain countries where there are issues with illnesses like river blindness, but ultimately it's used a lot in cattle drench or sheep dip, so that antiparasitic solution that you would drench livestock in to kill any parasites. It's not intended to be ingested at all. Chlorine dioxide, which is often sold under another name, MMS, bleach. It's used typically to bleach paper, but Lauren would drink that in a smoothie. Other things I found, bee sting therapy. So
What's bee sting therapy?
Bee sting therapy is a therapy where a person will sting themselves repeatedly with bees to try and treat Lyme disease. And then there's a few other types of things. So diets, this big one called Gerson therapy, which was popularized by Bell Gibson.
There's a lot of stuff there. I mean, what kind of impact was it having on her physically, but also socially as well? Like having such a regimented system there, she must have seemed a bit socially isolated, I would think.
Absolutely. When you're following these protocols, particularly things like Gerson therapy, which means that you can't eat really anything that's not organic, you need to be doing 5 coffee enemas a day. Those types of things meant that she wasn't able to kind of go far from home because she'd need to do these enemas or juicing. And so that means that you are kind of really restricting yourself. There's also, with some of these more dangerous treatments, so with drinking bleach and sheep dip, that comes with a lot of side effects. And so for somebody in Lauren's situation, they will often in these circles talk about herxing, which is a response that does have some basis in medical science, but it's essentially a reaction where having a treatment, as it kills off parasites in your system, you will experience an increase in symptoms. And while that is true for certain conditions and certain antibiotics, what that does is set the precedent for anyone to say, hey, try this treatment. And if you feel worse after taking it, that's a sign it's working.
This is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with author Hannah McElhinney, who's written a book about her cousin Lauren, who descended into a wormhole, a rabbit hole, while seeking controversial alternative medicine treatments overseas. Hannah, Lauren actually ended up dying overseas as a result of one of these treatments, an absolutely tragic situation. Your family must have been devastated. Like, what was going through your head when you found out?
When she had died, I think there was an initial shock of just what a horrific thing to have happened. But I noticed that I started to see connections. I started to think, well, hang on, Lauren didn't just wake up one day and think, I'm going to go and have drastic alternative medical treatment. She'd been making her way down this path for a long time. And I looked at things like algorithms, social media, things that I was seeing in culture. And I started to get the sense that Lauren was a symptom of a broader system and that she wouldn't be the only one who had taken such a tragic leap. I just found that I couldn't shake it. I think it was probably a way of grieving. I flung myself into intensive, obsessive research to try and understand what had happened to her. I got into the Facebook groups that she was posting in and operating in, and I sort of started to follow these digital footsteps. And as somebody with obsessive compulsive disorder, when I say I became obsessed with it, I mean that in that context.
As part of your investigation, you actually tracked down the doctor who performed Lauren's procedure in Malaysia. Can you tell us more about what happened, like what led up to her death and what you were able to find out about that doctor?
I was shocked to find that he was a respected oncologist with a lot of legitimate medical training in Malaysia and abroad. And so although it was strange that Lauren saw him, she didn't have cancer, and an oncologist does not really treat infectious diseases, let alone ones that are disputed as a diagnosis. It turns out he was offering a particular treatment, which is the one that Lauren underwent. Essentially, it's called hypothermia. And what they do is you are in something akin to a sort of solarium bed, I guess would be the best way of describing it. What happens is your body is heated to a very high temperature, at which point it's thought that the bacteria, the Lyme disease causing bacteria, would die off. They wouldn't be able to survive. What happened to her is, yeah, her body was heated up to 42 degrees. It continued to rise. It reached, you know, 42 and a half degrees. Her body was held there for multiple hours. And then the idea is that a person cools down naturally. However, we know that you're in a pretty significant health situation if your body temperature starts to get up towards 40. So above that is extremely dangerous.
In the book you say, yeah, Lauren's death did not occur in a vacuum, but a wormhole. What's a wormhole? It's the title of your book. What do you think that means?
It's something with layered meaning, but this idea of, I think, these algorithmic forces that suck us further into an area of the internet that we don't necessarily have control over or feel we have control over. And then the other area is this idea of time, because when we look at it in almost sci-fi way, if you go through a wormhole, you're sort of sucked into a place where time doesn't exist. And that's something that when I found different people that were in different stages of living with chronic, invisible, or mysterious illnesses, I did find that a lot of them actually had a really challenging time working out where their illness started and finished, what the shape of it was, what the chronology of it was. And then the third meaning is parasites. At the end of the day, this is a book about an obsession with parasites, both literal ones in what Lauren felt that she had, but then also from my own experience with OCD and feeling those kind of obsessive or pathological need to check or find things out.
Yeah, this is Hack. I'm Dave Marchese. I'm speaking with author Hannah McElhinney about her book Wormhole, which is a journey of discovery after her cousin Lauren died while seeking out controversial health treatments overseas. I'm asking you as well, like if you have maybe been through this, if someone close to you has maybe fallen down a wormhole and maybe you've struggled with your relationship with them because of that. Hannah, do you think this deep dive that you did on Lauren ended up meaning you got to know your cousin better, like the actions she was taking started to make a bit more sense to you?
Yeah. I think the saddest thing for me was I
got to know Lauren so much better after her death than I ever did while she was alive. And that has been a real motivating force to kind of talk about this a bit more, because I thought of her as, you know, a bit of a conspiracy theorist. You know, everybody's got one in their family. But when I started to look at what happened to her and I put it into a timeline, I actually found that everything that she did, there was a truth at the beginning of it, and there was a reason that she did it. And while a lot of it was based on misinformation, her logical steps were ones that I think so many people would take, especially if you're experiencing chronic pain or mysterious illnesses, or if you are a person of color or any other marginalized by medicine group, you are even more vulnerable, because not only you might be experiencing symptoms, but you might be having those symptoms dismissed by mainstream medicine.
So do you think Lauren was let down by the healthcare system, essentially?
Absolutely, in two ways. The first way, because her symptoms weren't believed or validated when she took them to, you know, those frontline health professionals. This is a systemic issue, certainly not one with individual practitioners, because there are so many people doing wonderful work. But when Lauren was further down this wormhole, my auntie would take her to, I guess you would call it, mainstream specialists, cardiologists, or, you know, infectious diseases specialists. For my auntie, she desperately wanted someone from the medical field to intervene and engage, but so often many of them just kind of hands up, shut down, not like fingers in their ears. In particular, one doctor rolled their eyes over Lauren's head while she was talking about some of the treatments that she was looking at. So there is this unwillingness to engage. And while I understand why, it's the removal of a point that could have kept that person connected to evidence-based treatment.
It's kind of a hard line as someone on the outside with a loved one. And as you say, there's probably someone listening now who can relate to this and has their own family or friend who is maybe going down a wormhole and they don't know how to best deal with it. Do you have any advice on that? Because, you know, it's, you want to support a person, but you also don't want to entertain dangerous ideas. You want to call stuff out, but you also don't want to isolate them.
Absolutely. And I think I have things that I would like to change about my own behavior. None of those things are going to, you know, bring Lauren back. But where I think we can focus our efforts as family members is the invalidation that people with these illnesses often feel. We can address that by just believing in the symptoms of our loved ones, even if we can't see them. It can be very frustrating to people in their lives when you don't understand what a loved one's going through and why they might be okay one minute, but the next minute they might be in severe pain. That frustration comes out of care. But if we can just make sure that we believe their symptoms, we validate their symptoms, and that they know that we are committed to supporting them as they find something that will help them, I think that goes a long way. I am certainly someone that used language like kooks or quacks, anti-vaxxers, putting kind of value judgments on certain ways of thinking. However, what that can mean is we can risk shaming our loved ones into concealment.
It's a great read and very engaging. I highly recommend it. It's called Wormhole. Author Hannah McElhinney, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us about it.
Thank you so much for having me.
And it's clear that there are so many people who've had similar experiences with family and friends. Someone saying, my father is a crazy conspiracy person, spreads his beliefs on health as well. The things he's done are crazy, but unfortunately I find there's no telling him. Another person saying, knowing people who are isolated because of their illness and so desperate for a cure, my heart really goes out to Lauren and anyone else who's been through this. Someone saying, I was led down a wormhole by an ex who convinced me to get off all my medication. I became really unwell and it took me a long time to recover and get better.
Hack on Triple J.
And that is all we've got time for on Hack for now. I'll catch you next time.
Hack.